Professor Karen Cox is the Vice Chancellor of the University of Kent, and it was an immense privilege to meet Karen for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. We talk about growing up in the Yorkshire Dales, studying nursing at university, her parents' background. We discuss some of the generational differences in terms of career opportunities and how it wasn't until Karen did her A-levels that university became an option. She talks about how she didn't really know anyone who had even been to university, but how she is fortunate that she's been able to do the things that she did, but that sometimes they are shaped by serendipity. We found out about her strong early memories of Christmases, including playing with boxes, wanting to be Margaret Fontaine. Tap dancing was a big influence, as was playing the trombone and horse riding, listening to the charts and writing down the charts on a Sunday. And we find out what the first record was that Karen bought. We discover how she ended up pursuing a career in nursing, who inspired her at university, about the wider student society interests around nursing and medicine that she pursued, how at university the combination of theoretical, practical and pastoral-based elements made for an excellent experiential learning opportunity. We talk about today's politics and how it is very eclectic. We find out what her reaction was when she heard that Jim Callaghan had been defeated by Margaret Thatcher in the general election of 1979. We share our radio passions. We find out which station she prefers to listen to. We find out who her favourite presenter is and why she considers radio to be a security blanket. In the final part of the interview, Karen explains why she is more of an optimistic person, why her memories are predominantly positive ones, what she dreamed of doing career-wise when she was young, why Karen has been more in touch with old friends in the last 18 months than ever before, and whether she is a looking back or a looking forward type of person. So join me, Chris DC, for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My guest this week is Professor Karen Cox. Well, it's my absolute pleasure to be with the Vice-Chancellor of the University of Kent, Professor Karen Cox, this afternoon. So thank you for being my guest this week.
No, Chris, it's a pleasure.
So do you want to say something, first of all, about a little bit about your background, where or when you were born?
Oh, when I was born, my goodness.
You don't have to give dates.
So I was born in a place called Horsforth. In West Yorkshire, and grew up first sort of 10 years in Pudsey, near Leeds, and then my parents in the late 70s, moved into the Yorkshire Dales, and so I spent the rest of my kind of teenage childhood years in the Yorkshire Dales, and then ended up going to university and in London. And then living in different places, career in nursing, and then moved into universities, so research and teaching, and then ended up as Vice Chancellor here. So it's not quite as straightforward as I just described, but that's broadly.
As I was saying just before we started recording, I went to the talk you gave from Pudsey to Professor, and something I found with so many of the interviewees is that no one ever woke up at the age of 5 or 15 and thought, I'm going to be an academic, I'm going to be a professor or indeed Vice Chancellor. So I think in a way everyone's route is circuitous. What about your parents? What did they do?
Oh my goodness. Both my parents didn't have professional careers as one would describe a sort of traditional, they were a teacher or they were an engineer. They both had careers that I think very much changed with the times. So my parents met in a company called Ferrantes. My dad was one of the, sort of worked on the shop floor. My mum worked in the wages office. And so they both left school at 16. They both went straight into work. I think they had ambitions around kind of quality of life, but not necessarily a kind of work career. They were really very much kind of concentrating on the two of them. They met when they were very young. They were 18 when they got married. And so I think they took work where it was. And interestingly, because they were working during the 70s when there was quite a lot of political and economic upheaval, My father was made redundant in the 70s, so he went on from Ferranti's to work for West Yorkshire Foundries, and was a, you know, worked on the foundry floor, but then got involved in trade union activity. So he was works convener and shop steward. Very involved in the 70s, of course, as all of that was unfolding. Made redundant in 1979. And so after that period, my father decided to set up on his own, just doing painting, decorating, cleaning windows, anything that would kind of earn cash. They'd also decided at this point to move from where we were in Pudsey because there was no work. Had an opportunity to set up doing that kind of business in the Yorkshire Dales. And so my mum supported that. She'd sort of done work, as I said, at wages clerk, admin jobs. Then when we were small, worked in Asda, did Avon, kind of fitted it around having kids. And then when we moved, she was basically taking up work when she could, so cleaning. So I suppose quite different to what I'm doing.
Yes, because my dad worked on the railway for 48 years, so he left school at 15 and stayed all the way through until retirement. Yeah. And it's a very different world, and I think...
Yeah.
But you were obviously then first-generation university as well.
Yes, I was. So it was something that... I mean, I think when I look back at my kind of parents' careers, so it's working lives, it's interesting in that I think there was never a question about them not working. So they always felt that it was important to earn a living, whatever that living was, and be proud of what you did. And that's been quite a strong, I suppose, learning point for me, really, reflecting back on my own career and talking with them. I talk with them much more now about the choices they made, particularly the choices they made when we were younger and they made that move from Pudsey to the Yorkshire Dales. I mean... You know, they didn't know how that was going to turn out. They left family and friends and took a real chance. And I just think that's brilliant in terms of it worked out. It gave us a quality of life in a beautiful place. Work for my father did work out. He was always busy, probably too busy at some points. And I think, you know, we had a life that we possibly wouldn't have had if we'd stayed in Pudsey.
Yeah.
So it's interesting just kind of reflecting on that in terms of how actually it's about the choices that you make and then making them work, whatever sphere of life that happens to be. And I think they don't regret anything actually about their particular working lives. I know they would, you know, say that for my sister and I, it was very much about making sure that we were happy and that we could then make the choices we wanted to.
It was, I realised just how privileged I was, because the expectation was that I would go to university.
Yeah.
But that wasn't something that my parents had done. But,
yeah.
You know, it was so... It, not so much inevitable, but it was just sort of like the timing of everything was right by the sort of late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah.
And you know, my parents didn't have the same opportunities that my sister and I did.
Yes.
And now we both work in the university sector. So,
yeah.
You know, so, you know, and I sort of look back and think, you know, nobody could ever have plotted that on a map.
No, absolutely. Yeah. And I think I'm the same, really. I look back and think, you know, what was it that kind of triggered that? I mean, I think it's, nobody ever said I couldn't go. But it wasn't until I was doing my A levels that it was actually raised as an option. Why don't you think about it? And that came from the FE college I was at. My parents are very supportive, but they didn't have that within their sphere of reference. And I was thinking the other day, did I actually know anybody who'd even been? And until I kind of, you know, was starting to think about what I wanted to do, you know, in those later years of schooling, that actually I was thinking, actually there was a kind of moment when I sort of remember suddenly talking about it, but prior to that it hadn't been on the agenda at all.
I always found that when I went back to my hometown in Cardiff and bumped into old school teachers and then realised that I followed a path which maybe they didn't.
Yes.
And suddenly you realise that, you know, part of me feels I'm still like 15 again.
Yeah.
But you, as you talk about what you've done, and you suddenly realise that the dynamic has changed completely.
Yeah,
but you just have a very different life experience.
Yes, And so I think that It kind of stays with you, doesn't it? Because there are things that shape you when you're younger, and the experiences that you have, the school system that you were in, the things that triggered you to think about particular things. I think they genuinely do shape then how you go on and think about what you want for your own career, what you then want for your children. Mm. And so I feel very fortunate that I was able to do the things that I was able to do and make those choices. But yes, you do, I think, realise increasingly how much they're shaped by sometimes serendipity, but sometimes just the fact that, you know, you were in a place and a space that was very supportive, but then those opportunities were kind of brought to your attention.
Yeah. But what about very earliest memories? How far can you go back? What do you remember, particularly from childhood?
Oh, whoa. Earliest memories. I remember being a very young child, and I remember playing with my sister a lot. I have some very strong memories of Christmases, actually. I remember, and this gets triggered at Christmas time, of course, but I remember playing with my sister when we kind of, all that sort of excitement before Christmas. I used to be sick every time because I got so excited. And I remember one Christmas, I must have been probably about seven, coming downstairs and seeing, I'd been desperate for this farmyard, that I, you know, toy farmyard and the toy animals and the kind of little stable yard. And this was all set out on the kind of living room floor. I remember that absolutely vividly. I remember earlier memories of Christmas seemed to be unwrapping boxes. I can't remember what was in them, but I have this image of my sister and I sort of pulling off wrapping paper. And so I think they're probably early memories around family and home. I don't remember much about school, but I think those kind of, you know, if I push myself and think back, then it would be particular almost snapshots of being in a particular room in the house. But around events, I think, is probably...
Yeah. No, Christmas is really interesting because I interviewed Mark Connolly from History recently, right. And we both have studied Christmas as part of our research.
Right, okay.
And yet Christmas, when I interviewed him, this was exactly the answer. Right. Initial memories Christmas. And yeah, I thought there's a pattern here. It's obviously that whole life trying to unpack that. And,
yes.
And you mentioned boxes. I mean, with my own children, I think they're more excited about getting inside the boxes rather than they then fight over the presents. But the boxes, so exciting. Who's got the biggest, but who can fit in?
Yes.
Can they both fit in?
Yes, I seem to remember playing in the boxes rather than being worried about what was in the boxes.
What did you enjoy doing as a child in terms of anything, maybe musically or sports?
Oh, I did quite a, I mean, I remember, so I had a few things going on. There were three things that I loved. One was ballet and tap dancing, and I remember wanting to be, you know, sort of Margot Fonteyn, and I used to have these pictures and just imagine being this amazing dancer. And I think I took it as far as various grades with tap. I think I was better at tap than ballet. But I did those things and I enjoyed it, and particularly enjoyed, we used to do, the little class that I was in, we used to go around old people's homes and kind of do dancing and things like that. So I did that. I did, I played the trombone. I started when I was about seven. And it was interesting because it was one of those things where I kind of, I don't recall ever picking it. I just have a memory of playing it, and I can't, it must have been through school and being given this thing. Enjoyed the sound, and enjoyed then the lessons, and we used to have a bit of a school orchestra. And I continued to play. It was never very good, but I continued to play. And then the other was horse riding, and that was a love of my mother's, and she'd done that as a child. And then, again, when we were in Pudsey, we used to go to a local riding stables. It was a real rag bag of a stables. And so I probably learnt to ride between the ages of sort of five and seven. And, continue to this day. But,
What about particular sounds? Like, for example, I mean, for me, growing up, being in the playground, it was always the charts. It was always, you know, we'd go to school on a Monday morning and it would be sort of, you know, we'd be talking about what we'd heard on the radio over the weekend. Did that impact on you at all?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, Top 40, love that. Yeah. I used to have my cassette recorder next to the radio. Yeah. You know, do I press it now? Am I going to get all the... Yeah, no, Top 40 was a big thing. Mm. And what was number one? And I think the first record I bought, I'm trying to think, was... Come From a Land Down Under,
Men at Work.
Yes, yes, I think that might be almost one of the first ones I bought. But no, loved that. I remember, you know, if we were going to any kind of party, or we'd always have music blasting out. And yeah, music was a big the pop music was a big thing. And I think that's continued. I mean parents listen to a lot of music, popular music. My husband teases me, and that he calls me a bit of a jukebox, that if something comes on the radio, I go, oh yeah, I know this one, happily sing along.
No, but I find it's a really good memory jogger as well, because I used to do what you do. I used to record and also write down the charts. And I used to think, actually, and I'm sure it's been a great skill in the profession now, because the whole sense of ordering everything, you know, a different colour for songs going up or going down. And there's actually that sort of like compartmentalising it, because I think my parents at the time thought, you know, you're wasting your life a little bit. But somehow, even now, 30 years on, you know, people will ask me questions, you know, sometimes like something come on the radio and the answer just comes, or even at conferences sometimes, and suddenly somebody, you know, wants to know, what was the name of that song?
Well, it was kind of, it was your sort of... if you like, your currency, wasn't it, in the playground? Yeah. So you could talk about it, who were you supporting, what was going up, what was going down. And I think, if you think about the way that music is now streamed, it's quite a different experience. And I think, you know, at the time, in the 70s in particular, and into the 80s, it was, you know, the thing that you could really all kind of talk about and focus on. And there were just a handful of songs that were kind of known, rather than the very eclectic mix that you tend to kind of get today. But it was fun, that. I do remember the pushing the button and trying to record it.
And in later years, I did the same as you, but then I digitised them a few years ago.
Right.
So I've got all those original recordings, not just from charts, but just...
Oh, wow. I don't think I could lay my hands on any recording
But it takes me back, and sometimes you hear the snippets of a presenter's voice.
Yes.
And you think, you know, Jimmy Young, or you think, who's now passed away. But it completely takes me back to the era.
Yeah.
And in some cases, I think, yes, I was recording that while I was thinking about writing an essay on so-and-so.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it's funny how background influences really impinge on us, but sometimes that combination of the lofty and the trivial, like listening to the music, but also I was doing sort of erudite things at the same time, but I couldn't have done one without the other.
Yeah, no, and I think that, again, because we used to, as a family, used to have music on, the radio in particular, I think that it does trigger, you hear songs and then that triggers a particular memory or event. And I also remember, for me, it triggers memories of being at my grandparents. And you know, the big sort of, they used to have a sort of sideboard record and radio, radiograms, and you know, that it's kind of, I'll hear a record and think, oh, I remember being at my grandparents listening to that. That's good stuff.
Yeah, no, absolutely, and that completely stayed with me then. But to the point that now, though, with my own children, I have no idea what was... I've looked it up, but I can't retain what was in the charts when they were born. But anybody who was born in the 60s before me, or 70s, or certainly 80s, you know, I'd be able to at least narrow it down to the mark.
Yes.
I was actually one colleague, she was born, I remember, like November 62. She said, I bet you can't guess what was number one. And it was a guess, and I said, it was probably Frank Ifield. And I thought, you know, it was. And I just thought, I don't know where that
really
came from.
Is.
And I there's something in that.
Jukebox knowledge.
Absolutely, but what inspired you then to enter academia? Because you mentioned the nursing
profession.
So it sounds as though you had a very circuitous route.
Well, yes and no, in that I... so I chose nursing, really, on the back of work experience that I'd had in a local hospital, and originally gone for a week's work experience in you know, the laboratory, and found myself in a ward environment, and had this almost sort of revelation of this is where I want to be. So nursing became the career that I chose. That was when I was engaging around, actually, you could do this at university, and the advice that I had and the support I had. So I ended up going to King's College London. Absolutely fantastic, loved it. But it was there, really, that it completely changed my thinking about what I might do as a career. So moving from thinking about nursing as a clinical career to thinking about where nursing might take me in terms of clinical, but also teaching and research. And I think that was because of the role models that I saw at university and engaged with at university, that meant that after I qualified, graduated, I specialised in oncology and palliative care. And this idea about actually going back and working in a university never went away. And so I ended up kind of thinking about it more and more, and deciding I was going to go back and do a PhD. Mm. And so I ended up back at the University of Nottingham. Mm. But yeah, it was. I think the seeds were sown when I was an undergraduate. I loved the environment. I loved everything about it. It just opened up a completely new world for me. Mm. And
were there particular teachers, lecturers who inspired
you? Yes, there were. And it was so interesting that you've raised that, because there was the professor at the time, she became a professor whilst we were in our first year, I think, a woman called Jennifer Wilson Barnett, absolutely fantastic. And she interviewed me for my place at King's. So I was always very grateful to her for offering me a place. I remember we must have only been in the course about 6 weeks, and she was trying out her inaugural lecture, so we were her guinea pigs, and we were kind of like sat there thinking, no idea what you're on about, you know. So I have that vivid memory of her kind of articulating her sort of thoughts, views, work that she'd been doing. But she was one of the first nurses to do a PhD in the UK, and brought that sort of ambition into the classroom with us, really, in terms of her own career development. She'd worked clinically for a number of years, been intellectually hungry, wanted to develop her own kind of career in terms of research and teaching, and had found herself doing a PhD, doing teaching, and ultimately heading up the School of Nursing at King's College London. But interestingly, I heard her interviewed on a local radio station, I think it must have been 2014, talking about and reflecting on her career. And it's a long time since I graduated from King's, and I've had the odd bit of contact with her, but it was really nice to hear her voice again. And it was the sound of her voice and the way she talked about nursing and its importance and the impact that it has on people's lives, and not just in a kind of, you know, that nurses are important locally, but globally in terms of healthcare. Really inspirational, and it kind of brought back all of those early memories of you know, joining King's, being inspired by it. So Jenny Wilson Barnett would if you had to ask me my nursing hero, it would be her.
No, I remember the real privilege, I think it was in 2009, of inviting one of the professors who taught me in theology in the University of Wales to a conference in Germany that I was co-organising. And I remember hearing him speak, and it really struck me how influential he had been on my research, because he did a lot of stuff on near-death experiences, life after death.
Yeah.
And my research a few years ago was in life after death in film. And I realised that I'd taken as a basis what he taught me all those years ago and moved it in a different sort of direction. But I realised then on social media, when I mentioned some of my own teaching in a course on death and the afterlife, people from different generations in the university I went to all saying, gosh, that was the most important sort of set of lectures I ever went to. Right. All of them in different years, but different generations of students. Yeah. So, you know, it's really powerful, isn't it, when you go back?
Yeah, and I think if you asked anybody of sort of my generation, Jenny Wilson Barnett would be a name that people would probably pick up on and reflect on.
And in terms of what else was going on at university, I mean, things like, we mentioned music and about film, and was there anything sort of particularly that you remember from doing as an undergraduate or a postgraduate that, you know, so you were studying, but also, I'm guessing in classes a lot more than I was, because we had 3 or 4 hours of lectures a day, but I'm guessing that you probably had more
hours. For me, it was incredibly full on. So I remember first year was very much, so we were living in halls of residence, having to travel. So that was based out in Wandsworth. Travelled back into the centre of London for lectures. So lots of getting on buses, then getting a bike, because that was much quicker and more straightforward. I remember university as being a time of, if you like, kind of, well, rapidly growing up, but also quite busy and full on. So combining the lectures with clinical work is really quite a challenge. I was fortunate that my work was spread over 4 years. It was a four-year programme. But we had a lot of fun as well. We set up new societies. I seem to remember we spent quite a lot of time organising end-of-year balls. but all of that, getting involved in wider activities, was quite hard when you were on the kind of course that I was on. So a lot of the time, it was trying to squeeze those things in around the edges. I sometimes look back on my university career and wish I'd, in a way, been able to make more of the wider activities that were going on. But you have to kind of work with what you've got at the time. In terms of time, we didn't have a huge amount to be able to spend on other things, really.
No, and because I was in a small campus-based university, we'd always see the same people. And one thing I do remember is this great sort of balance that I'd be, you know, often in the computer room all day. But by, you know, in the evening, we'd often congregate and we'd play. I've never played pool in my life, but I played pool, but not in any sort of successful way. Or just sort of congregating. But it's that balance, that intersection.
Yeah.
And that's really stayed with me. So even now, sometimes when I'm even teaching my own students or reflecting on essays I wrote all those years ago, I'm sort of often aware that there were lots of sort of wider undercurrents, which fleshed out some of those academic and theoretical constructs.
Absolutely. I mean, I think I was very conscious that we were in a pretty privileged position in terms of being at university, but also engaged in the NHS. So in the sort of late 80s, there was quite a lot of change. Well, there's always been quite a lot of change going on in the NHS. But at the time, there were issues around restructuring, the kind of whole managerialism. And there were quite a lot of strikes on at the time as well around pay and conditions, not that dissimilar to what's currently going on, and you kind of got involved on the fringes of that, but I think that sort of broader what was going on in London as well was quite interesting at the time, because you had a real mix of I suppose a sort of growing awareness of what it meant to be kind of more politically active, through whether that was through student union activities. But also, I think when you interface with a public service, you get a different sense of a bigger world out there than if you're focused on a particular discipline that doesn't necessarily have that kind of interface. So I will often, though, look back at my university experience and think, I wish I could have accelerated some of that learning and understanding about how to make the most of university. And so when I went back to university, for example, to do I went back for a year to do my district nursing community health course and also my PhD, you very quickly know, right, I need to register for this, I need to work out that. And actually, I made much more of my time when I was doing my district nursing and when I was doing my PhD than I probably did as an undergraduate. Uh-huh. And it's kind of partly the programme itself, but also partly your own sense of, I know now how to get the most out of it. And I just wish I'd been able to do a bit more of that.
But unlike me, you were very much dealing with real people.
So very much
hands-on, very practical based, pastoral-based even.
And I think I love the mix of the theoretical and looking at the underpinnings of a particular theoretical sort of perspectives on some of the issues around interpersonal communication, for example, and then actually how that plays out in a real-life scenario. Mm. And some brilliant assignments where we had to apply that learning to real life interactions, whether that was observed or audio or a kind of mix of the two. And brilliant learning, because of course you've got the classroom based study as well as the real thing. And I think for me, it kind of chimed with how I probably learn best, which is experiential learning. But the opportunity to always come back and reflect on that, I think, was really powerful.
Because I was often struck that I felt that I was living in a bit of a bubble sometimes, because we could study all these wonderful ideas and write essays and go to the library and study everything, but then we'd be having our hair cut or we'd be in the supermarket and say, why are you studying this?
And I even did the other day with
my children at McDonald's, and you know, the sort of question came up, so why are you studying theology? Do you have a faith background?
Yeah.
And suddenly it's very interesting, because you can spend 3 hours with the students and having, you know, a to and fro on all of these sensitive issues and debates, but sometimes you find yourself in a more vulnerable position sometimes when you're dealing with somebody who's asking from a point of view outside of the academy. They're wonderful life lessons, but it always makes me reflect on them. But in terms of other things that happened at university, you mentioned political sort of activism or lots of... Because my sense when I was at university is that people weren't all that interested in politics. I mean, the Conservatives were in power at the time, and I don't remember life much before 1979. Yeah. I vaguely remember the tail end of the Labour government. But and then there was a period in the 90s when there was a by-election in the university where I was, and I didn't get the sense that people were particularly motivated. Yeah. But it just feels so different now, even on this campus and, you know, the 2017 election.
Yes. Yeah.
And huge amounts of activism. And it just reminds me of a mature student that I taught about 15 years ago who did a degree in the 1960s. And she was saying that everybody there was always campaigning,
yes,
they were going on marches.
Yeah,
she said
yeah.
students today are just not interested in that sort of thing.
I mean, I think for me, I think it was more about... So there were the external issues, so the NHS piece was kind of going on. I think I was involved only... I wasn't involved actively in the student union. It was more society activity that we were involved with around sort of nursing and medicine. And it was more how we were... I think we were focused on two things. One was how do we make sure, given our... what were sometimes ridiculous timetables, in that you were, you know, scheduled from 9 on Mondays to whatever on Fridays, and doing clinical shifts. Yeah. So that meant that you didn't really have time to kind of fit in with what else might be going on. So how are we offering each of the support, but also how are we lobbying the university around particular issues relating to that in terms of our learning, in terms of the support we wanted? But it didn't really go much beyond that. And I think you're right. I think there was a period in the sort of 60s, 70s where there was much more student activism. I think that probably did decline for probably the next 20 years almost. Mm. I still think it's quite different today. I think there's partly the way that communication happens, globalisation, and I think the sort of, and social media means that our current politics are much more visible. There is a greater opportunity for people to get involved at all sorts of levels. Then I think that is changing the way that we think about democracy, the way that we think about how we can influence it. And I think that's playing through in terms of people also in new situations at university taking the opportunity to almost try some of that stuff out, often for the first time. I'm not sure how politically active young people are in schools. And I think university gives them an opportunity to really start to think about who they are, how they want to influence, and how they want to participate in ways that you can't necessarily do in a kind of school.
No, so I was very conscious at university of friends of mine. The 92 election was the first one. We'd all just turned 18.
Yeah.
And a lot of people were voting according to the patterns of their parents.
Yes.
Very much. They weren't so much politically active, but there was no question that they would vote for whichever party their parents did.
Yeah.
And I've often wondered whether in subsequent years they may have, you know, reflected on that.
I think that politics today is much less clear than it used to be. Now, that may be just me constructing that. But I agree with you. In the 70s, I was very aware, partly because of the kind of work my father did. But I remember when the 79 election results were known, I thought the world had ended.
Yeah.
Because my dad was just completely, James Callaghan had lost, Margaret Thatcher. And I just thought, whoa, what does this mean, you know? And I suppose I was very influenced by him and his take on that. And it was my father, not my mother. And interestingly, if I think about now the conversations that we have, it's not as straightforward. It used to be two-party politics. Now it's just all over the place.
I remember those election debates when David Cameron said he would do one in 2015, and you had the two nationalist parties, Wales and Scotland, UKIP, Lib Dem,
I mean,
Green.
It's a completely different landscape. So I think we've gone from a kind of engagement where whatever your politics, there was at least clarity around a sort of set of values from where they were coming from and ideologies. And now it feels quite different in terms of almost a much more eclectic sort of mix of views and issues in quite a melting pot, I think.
Yeah. No, because I remember quite a few people at university would often say, oh, I don't bother to vote because they're all the same, doesn't matter who you vote for. And of course, politicians back then in the 90s were trying to capture the centre ground.
Yes.
I don't think they're saying the same thing now.
No, absolutely. And then, of course, we also saw the sort of rise of New Labour, didn't we, in terms of that coming through. And I remember the sense of almost a kind of, whoa, this is a completely new beginning, this is exciting, this is new and different. And again, you kind of follow that through and see how over time that kind of shifted and changed again.
But I was drawn by something you said earlier about radio. You said about the radio. Was that something even at university that was always on in the background? For me, I mean, everything was almost sort of, you know, the radio was the soundtrack to my life.
Yes.
Quite literally.
Yeah, I'd say,
was there particular programmes or stations that you remember?
I'm a bit of a Radio 2 fan.
Yeah,
I'm trying to think. So the radio was probably something right from my always on in the background. I remember it was some, as I said, at my grandparents' house, in our house, my mum singing. And there's a kind of I sometimes laugh at myself if I go home. My parents always singing. My mum particularly. And so that was always very natural, very normal. And then going to university, it was kind of the cassette player and the radio. Mm. So love radio too. Steve Wright was a and still is. I love Steve Wright in the afternoon.
Yeah.
I will listen to Radio 2 in the mornings. Yeah. I mix. So get up first thing. It's Radio 4, and then as I'm coming into work, it's Radio 2.
Yeah, and I found yesterday, because I was torn between Zoe Ball's new breakfast show and John McDonnell, who was being interviewed on the Today Program.
And I
thought these are quite incongruous,
yeah.
But actually in a funny way. It's funny, we were talking about politics a moment ago, but I remember shortly after Neil Kinnock lost the 92 election, he did quite a few Radio 2 shows, and he sat in for both Jimmy Young and John Dunn.
Yeah.
And the incongruity of the man who almost became Prime Minister reading the travel news.
Yes,
thankfully, I've got some snippets of this, and also there's Jeffrey Archer playing Barbara Streisand and Neil Diamond song. And again, I just thought, this is priceless, because it's almost like you couldn't make this up.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Especially in the light of everything that happened since. So, you know, Radio 2, and they had Michael Howard doing the Jeremy Vine show back in the summer.
And it's a great... Yeah. And I think the radio, for me, is something that, in a way, it's a pleasure. It's also a bit of a security blanket. I find it quite therapeutic having it on. It changes throughout the day. I love the kind of the news items, music items, kind of, you know, drama as well. I just love the rhythm of it, and the sort of certainty that, you know, if you put it on a particular time on a particular station, you kind of know what you're going to get.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And the intimacy of the relationship between... Yeah, I've never been quite so keen on the Zoo format sometimes, when you feel that the presenters are talking to each other.
Yeah.
But there's nothing better than having the presenter and the listener, and it's a very intimate and special
thing. Absolutely. And I think that's what people like Steve Wright were very, very good at, and still good at.
Yeah. A few more philosophically sort of based questions to wrap up. Would you say your memories are predominantly positive?
Yes, I think they are. I mean, I think I'm generally, I've said this before in other forums, a sort of cup half full person. I'm optimistic, and I've been very fortunate in terms of the way that things have unfolded for me. So my memories are very positive, both from childhood and even from, you know, yesterday, you know, it's kind of...
Because I often reflect, and it comes into my research as well, this whole question of whether it's possible to be nostalgic about negative experiences.
Yeah.
Because that whole sort of character building thing. Yeah. Sometimes you think, okay, this didn't work.
Yeah.
But it's how you dealt... I mean, as an undergraduate, my sense was having deadlines all the time.
Yeah.
And suddenly thinking, I know nothing about this topic. But then doing the research, and then after a week or two, you think, well, actually, I can contribute to this debate.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And even now, I look back and think, well, the fact that I could do that within a very small time scale, almost like conveyor belt, because then there'd be another essay.
Yeah, yeah,
but the challenge there, and I thought, there was a lot of stress and anxiety. We didn't know what jobs we'd have. We didn't know whether we'd get a good mark for our essays.
Yeah.
And yet, somehow, there was a real richness and a challenge in that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I sort of remember that. And I think, you know, those are life skills that I've carried with me since.
No, absolutely. And I mean, I think... You know, I'm not saying that everything that's happened to me has always been marvellous, because, of course, we all have our challenges. And I think, for me, the biggest learning points have always been when something's not gone as you would have liked, or as well as you've liked, or you've not got something, or something traumatic's happened, whether that's on a personal level or something that you've experienced at work, and particularly working in the kind of clinical environments that I was in. that, you know, these could be quite traumatic days sometimes, and you would go home both physically and emotionally exhausted. But it's then how you make sense of that, and how you take some of that learning into, well, actually, I can take something from this. And it does make you, I think, better in terms of what you're doing. Yeah. And I always say, I still have this little mantra that I was probably more stressed as a staff nurse than I have ever been in any of the sort of senior leadership roles. And that for me is about the nature of the job. And so I think that there is a lot to be learned from things that don't go well, but it's about how we're able to respond, and sometimes we're able to respond more positively at different times in our lives, and because it depends what else is going on, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So I think a lot of this is it's kind of quite dependent on a number of things. Mm. And I often will say, you know, if things are going well in your personal life, that probably helps work, and vice versa. Yeah. The these things are all intertwined.
Yeah, they play off each other, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Would you say that you've fulfilled the dreams you had when you were young? I mean, obviously, speaking to the Vice Chancellor, I mean, it's sort of like, you can't get much.
The dreams I had when I was young. I mean, I mean, I suppose when I was young, I wanted to be a PE teacher, then I wanted to be, you know, scientist, then I wonder, you know, you kind of want to be different things, don't you? I still have dreams. I don't think I've kind of necessarily achieved all I want to achieve. For me, a lot of it now is about, and I think it probably was then, it was about doing something that was interesting and challenging and worthwhile. And you end up kind of making choices, don't you, in terms of what might be presented in front of you. And then you find yourself in a particular place at a particular point in time. But I think it's it's interesting to reflect on what are kind of dreams, hopes, ambitions, and are there still things that you kind of want to achieve that aren't quite there yet?
Because sometimes it feels that it can be a both and rather than either or.
Yeah.
I mean, I suppose actually in terms of even this interview series, the sense of sort of, well, I always wanted to do something in radio, so it's kind of a way of bridging that.
But
I've always been, you know, that whole sort of question as to whether one dreams about doing something as a child or at university, and whether then you feel disappointed that you haven't achieved that, but you've on the other hand, you might have defined the role that you're doing and done something on your own terms which you couldn't have anticipated, so you sort of, like, you know, squared the circle.
I mean, I think there's I think for me, I take a lot of comfort and pleasure from sort of thinking about what might be around the corner, because I find that quite exciting. So I kind of, in a way, don't want to stop thinking or dreaming or kind of having a different take on where I might end up or what I might end up doing. And that's not all about in a work scenario either. So I suppose I daydream quite a lot, and I sort of think about, well, you know, in a few years' time, I might be able to do A, B, and C, and that for me is, I find it really kind of motivating in a way that's not about a career choice necessarily. It's more about being happy in life, and I think I've maybe, to a greater or lesser extent, kind of drawn on that as I've kind of gone through life, as it were. And because for me, it is that being able to be forward-looking that keeps things exciting.
Yeah. And on that journey that you've been on, are you in touch with many friends from your past, from when you were growing up? You must have, along the way, there must have been so many different networks that you
had. Yeah, that's interesting. Because so I suppose from being at school, probably, not on a regular basis. There might be the odd one if I go back to an event with family or something that I might meet up with. I think what's happened is more recently, as we've made a life change and moved here, we've actually found that we've been more in touch with old friends than we ever have before. And I think some of that is partly you getting in touch, say we've moved, I think it's partly our own children growing up and leaving and going elsewhere. So it's a kind of life stage thing, I think, as well. But yeah, in the last 18 months, I've probably reconnected with more people from the last 20 years than before. So it's been quite... My husband and I were reflecting on that only at the weekend, actually.
Yeah, and I've been navigating my way through social media in a way that I never thought I would. I never thought I'd be the sort of person who'd be on Facebook. But I've connected and in some ways continued those conversations from 25 years ago.
And
literally finished off, or you know, started off from where we finished all those years ago. And you realise that there's an authenticity in relationships.
And
I'm really glad to have made that reconnection.
So the reconnection's been... It's been really nice, actually. And in a way, one of the nice things, as you said, is that you realise these are deep friendships when you're able to pick up from almost where you left off and that the gap in the middle doesn't matter. But yeah, no, that's been one of the nice things the last few months.
And my very last question, would you consider yourself a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
I think I've just described... I am a looking forward person. My husband loves to say to me, Karen, you need to enjoy the golden present, not be looking for the golden future. And I mean, I do. I mean, I use reflection as a way of being able to take learning from things. In terms of looking back as a kind of in the longer term, I probably do that less. I like to think about positive memories, though, in terms of, oh, that was a great time, or I enjoyed that, or that was a really nice phase. But actually, no, I'm much more forward-looking and kind of interested in what's next and what's around the corner.
Karen Cox, thank you very much.
No, thank you, Chris.